Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, we hope your device stays locked onto our website, kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis. This show's called Our Town. The show highlights some of the diverse personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington so very special. Our Town profiles people from all walks of life, from firefighters to foodies, from bus drivers to baristas, even the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. Our mission is to introduce our listeners to some of the fascinating people who make up the complex fabric of this community. Listening to Our Town lets you meet some of the vibrant, complex characters who help give this community its unique personality. Our Town is a window on the people of Jefferson County, Washington. Recently, the Port Townsend Leader ran an obituary of Carlin Stark, a remarkable woman who gave so much to our community. Carlin was a guest on Our Town a while back, before she became seriously ill. We thought it would honor her memory to rerun that episode of Our Town for you today. When I did that interview, her great spirit was already beginning to crumble, and some of her vivid memories were beginning to fade. I visited her at her modest home in Uptown before recording the show. When she would begin to lose thread of the conversation, her assistant softly suggested that I walk around the house with her, get her to talk about the pictures on the walls. And there it was, an amazing past. There were several husbands and multiple children, but there were also pictures of her father and grandfather with American legends. People like Franklin Delano Roosevelt and J. Edgar Hoover were among the dignitaries on the wall of that house in Uptown Port Townsend. Carlin didn't put on airs, but she came from immense wealth. She was part of the Kaiser family, you know, the family that created what is now Kaiser Permanente, Kaiser Industries, Kaiser Steels, and the Kaiser Family Foundation. She loved the Pacific Northwest. She ran Camp Four Winds, Westward Ho, on Orcas Island for several years. I believe at one point her family owned that camp. It's still a fixture in the Northwest, a place where kids still wear uniforms and both listen to and create music and poetry. They also sail on a 61-foot yawl, fittingly named the Carlin. Her ties to Port Townsend run deep. She was one of a small group of people who helped make the Northwest Maritime Center a reality, not just a dream. Carlin is survived by five children, multiple grandchildren, and even a few great-grandchildren, and she is vividly remembered by many in the boating community here. So let's listen to the interview she gave to Our Town. Welcome to the show, Carlin.
Thank you.
Let's start at your beginning. Were you born and bred in the Pacific Northwest?
Nope. I was born in Washington, D.C., where my grandparents, on both sides of my family, were discussing building of Boulder Dam or Bonneville Dam. Bonneville Dam, I think it was. And the two grandparents, my grandfather was Henry J. Kaiser, who was a builder, and my father was Edgar Kaiser, who was head of Kaiser Construction. So my grandfather, the Meade, was head of the Bureau of Reclamation, so they were planning the dams to provide water. So my grandparents were getting together, and they discovered they each had a son and a daughter about the same age, and they introduced them to each other.
So it was fortunate. Yeah. I gather there must have been a big society-type wedding.
No.
No?
No, they were married in my maternal grandparents' living room.
Okay. So how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I'm the oldest of six.
I see. When you were growing up, your father was in construction a lot of that time, right? So did you move around a bit?
Yes, we did. My earliest recollection is Bonneville Dam, and that was pre-grade school, Bonneville, and then we went to Grand Coulee. Yeah, I remember that. It was fun. I loved the construction. Our father used to take us out in the skips over the job so we could see what was going on and tell us all about how they poured concrete. You know, I got really pretty fascinated with how the whole system worked, how the water supply worked, and what it all came from. And, you know, it was just, I was very interested.
Yeah, that sounds really neat to see from a young age.
Yeah.
Did you ever think you might go into that field yourself, become an engineer or something like that?
No, but I wish I had.
Yeah, well, sometimes. So you moved around a lot, and you lived in construction camps. Was that an interesting thing to do?
Because we were the boss's kids, the workers' kids all threw stones at us and yelled and chased us home. And my mother would say, but what did you do to them? They wouldn't just do that. And we would say, we didn't do anything. You know, they were sixth graders and we were first graders and they were throwing rocks at us and they were boys. And anyway, we survived.
That doesn't sound pleasant. What did you do during the summertime?
Because, again, of the community friction, my parents sent us to a summer camp on Orcas Island, Four Winds. Then they came up to visit us there, and they fell in love with the island, so they bought a big piece of property next door to the summer camp and had a summer home there for all the years that we were growing up.
Tell me a little bit about the camp. What did you do at the camp?
Well, they were really pretty amazing. They had 80 small boats, war canoes, and we'd pack six kids and all their gear in a war canoe and head them off for a week trip around the San Juan Islands in the days when they were a lot less crowded. So we had 20 horses. We had riding and jumping and a lot of equestrian stuff, and we had a building full of weaving looms because we were there for a long period over the summer. We had time to actually weave a set of table mats for our long-suffering parents.
You told me earlier that there was a lot of poetry.
Yeah, we had a hardbound poetry book that was part of the camp. You could get that at the camp store, and we recited poetry at evening fires. And because everybody was reciting them over and over, we all learned them. Mother said we were walking anthologies of English poetry when we got out of that camp.
Do you remember any of the poems?
Yes. The ones we used to teach to little kids to get up and recite was, "The air is like a butterfly with pale blue wings. The happy earth looks at the sky and sings." But more appropriate for me was, "Sun, wind, beat of sea, great lands stretching endlessly. Where be bonds to bind the free? All the world was made for me."
That's nice. You said they had 80 boats?
Yeah.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah.
Little, big, some of each?
Well, there were Willett's canoes, which are the molded wood strip canoes. You know, they had to be sanded and varnished every year. They were beautiful canoes. And we had some small fiberglass canoes. The Willett's canoes were like two people. Maybe you could put a person in the middle, but two paddlers. And then there were the war canoes that would hold six people and all their gear for a trip, or 13 people if you wanted to have the big races, which we did. My mother always said they looked like centipedes having a fit. You know, anything you wanted to do, almost, you could do. The rule was that you could do anything you wanted to do as long as it didn't hurt yourself or anyone else.
Well, that's a very sensible rule.
Yeah.
What was the age group? Did this camp go from little first graders up through high school?
Yes. My sister started going there when she was 5.
And you went there through your high school years? Where'd you go to high school, by the way?
Which year? I started out at University High School in Ann Arbor. Then my parents sent me to Kingswood in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. It's a very good school, but it was just straight upper crust society, and everybody was talking about their debuts and coming out and their ball gowns and stuff. And it was so far over my head, I said I was a fish out of water. I was miserable there. Then my parents sent me to the boarding school my mother went to, which was Madeira, and I loved it. It was out in the backwoods outside of Washington, D.C., and we had a hiking club, and we could get the kitchen to pack us picnic lunches, and we could go off hiking and go down to the Potomac and hang out. And we had a little pond that froze over in the winter in the Potomac that we could skate on, and it was just a wonderful place.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Obviously, you enjoyed it.
Yeah, and great teachers, and yeah, I enjoyed it all.
What did you do after you finished high school? What was next?
I went to Bryn Mawr. I went there for 2 years, and then I left to get married. I needed to get out of my home. My father had a horrendous, raging temper. I got to the point where I couldn't do anything in class or anything except sit and recite what I was going to say back to him after all the nasty things he'd said. I wasn't learning anything. I couldn't hear what the teacher was saying. I just said, this isn't working.
Okay, well, you were obviously very young when you married your first husband.
Yeah, 21.
Yeah. Did you have any children?
5.
5 children. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an accomplishment.
Yeah, they're all pretty neat kids.
That's good to hear. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. The show's called Our Town. I'm the host, Maryam McNellis. Our Town profiles some of the fascinating people who live on the Olympic Peninsula. We talk about their experiences, their lives. Today, our guest is someone who has lived a remarkable and adventurous life, Carlin Stark. So, Carlin, you were only 21 mm-hmm. when you got married. And when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that you got married at your grandfather's home on Hawaii.
Yes.
Now, your grandfather was Henry Kaiser.
Yes.
And he was a...
He was an industrialist.
Industrialist. Mm-hmm. Did he have a...
Because they had steel mills and aluminum plants and all that stuff.
So on Hawaii, what was that like? Did he have a big mansion-type house and lovely grounds where the wedding was taking place?
Well, I was actually married in a neat little church. I can't even remember the name of the church now, but it was isolated out on a point in Hawaii. Yes, he had a mansion. Mm-hmm. Swimming pool and all that stuff.
So you had five kids pretty much in the row, and they're all grown up now. So without going into much detail, what are they doing these days?
My daughter Kathy's a CPA. My son David, who's the next one down, was a paranoid schizophrenic who was also extremely competent at anything he tried to do. Mm. I went to pet him assessed by the University of Washington and everything, and they basically said there's nothing you can do. He doesn't need to be warehoused. He's not a danger. So he just went his own way and wandered off and camped out in Guatemala and raised goats and pigs. And then he studied up with the U.S. Agricultural College stuff, and they sent him down stuff about how to grow more corn and more beans in the same place and how to fertilize with the stuff that you would have thrown away normally, which he did. And so his yields got much higher, and he tried to teach the natives how to do that themselves, and they said it was too much work and he must be a witch, and they ran him out of town.
Oh, dear. That's not good. Well, that's, I don't know about that. What about Kim? What does she do?
Kim is married and lives in Medical Lake, Washington. And she is basically volunteers. She clowns, and she clowns in the hospitals for...
The Shriners.
Shriners, yes. She clowns for Shriners. And she volunteers for anybody.
So. And then Robin is...
Robin is a commercial interior designer. She does things like when a company is setting up their new offices somewhere, she goes in and interviews everybody, finds out what desks they need, what computer systems they need, what lighting systems they need. She orders it all, she installs it all, and moves them all in.
And Mead is your youngest.
Yeah.
And what does Mead do?
Mead works for the Bank of America, and he's a property assessor.
Okay. Now, earlier when we were talking, you were telling me about something you're very passionate about, which was the UN. And you and your husband went on a speaking tour. Can you talk a bit about that?
With my third husband. I've been very active with the United Nations Association in the Bay Area. My grandfather was actually one of the people who helped found the United Nations.
Wow.
And my birthday is on United Nations Day, so there it is. But that was an accident. And it was a time when there was a lot of get the U.S. out of the U.N. And my husband was a lawyer, one of the heads of the World Peace Through Law Organization, which realized you have to have legal terms that are translatable into other countries and cultures. And they would have meetings with bar associations, with head judges from all over the world, and have a strange fake trial on things where something had gone wrong in one country, had fallen out of the sky on another country, and that somebody else had built the equipment that went wrong, and who was at fault, that kind of trial where you can't just have one judge. You need judges from all the countries. And so he was very active in that kind of thing.
So you went all across country in a motorhome.
Yeah.
Giving speeches.
Right.
But the image that sticks in my mind is what you told me about ironing. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, that was in the days before you could have these wonderful shirts that you throw in the washing machine, and they come out looking like they're fresh from the store. He wore a coat and tie and a jacket and a nice shirt, but I had to wash and iron the shirts. So we'd stop at a laundromat somewhere and then park under a tree, and I'd plug the iron into the generator and iron his shirts under a tree.
Iron the shirts under a tree.
Yeah.
There's an image. And the next day when he was speaking, nobody knew. Didn't you also play the guitar?
Yeah, I usually played the guitar before. He spoke on, peace songs. If I were free to speak my mind, I'd tell the world of all mankind, of how the flowers do bloom and fade, of how we fought and how we paid. And it was really kind of fun because the older guys actually would sit in the audience and cry, which is, I thought was wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah.
But obviously we've skipped over a few things because I've got a feeling that this was not your first husband that you were doing the UN speeches with, right?
No, that's no. True.
This was with Mr. Stark?
It was my third husband.
Your third husband, okay.
My first husband was a mistake.
Right.
And that's enough said about that.
Yeah, no, these things happen.
And then my next husband, at that point, I was trying to support five children on a job running a summer camp, and the salary wasn't big enough, plus which it required 24/7 hours of my time and a lot of travel.
Right.
So that meant you had to have really good household help to help all the children grow up and so forth. So when a wealthy parent of one of my families of children that came to camp proposed to me, I realized he could afford all of us, so I said yes. And moved to Vancouver, and he was very sweet, very generous, but his only interest was the social world, the social life, party, 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 know who has the money, know who has the power, and I just got so bored because there was no other topic about art or music or gardening or sewing or anything. And I started drinking. Well, I mean, I was drinking, and he didn't want me to drink less, so he would pour brandy in my coffee in the morning. Finally, I just said, I got to get sober, and I just left the marriage. I said, I don't want anything. I'm just leaving. I went to a home my parents had built on Orcas for my use. I went and hunkered up there with nothing. He had been through a divorce before where he was sued for millions of dollars, and so he sent me a check for $5,000, which got me through that period, and I didn't ask for it, so it all ended up right. We ended up friends.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
I'm still, his children still call me for advice, and we chat.
So at that time, you were running the camp on Orcas, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You had a lot of responsibility there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, huge.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
The camp still exists today, and it's now a foundation.
Yes.
Was it a foundation in those days?
No. The owner had been relying on parents to come in and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars repairing cabins and rebuilding buildings and equipping the kitchen, and parents kept saying this should be a nonprofit. So eventually, when she was ready to retire, and I was looking for a job because I needed to be able to support the children.
Right.
And I wanted to get out of my marriage, and I didn't want to go through a lot of legal stuff. I just wanted to leave.
Your husband, Mr. Stark, was a lawyer in Oakland, right? So how did you meet him?
His son, Wallace Stark, was my waterfront director. I was really good at water activities. I was a good sailor, a good canoer. I had taught all those things when I was at the camp. He was 12 years younger than I was, and he asked me to marry him. And I just giggled because he was very sweet, but he was still a kid in graduate school. So he said, well, if you won't marry me, you should marry my father. So he brought his father up with me saying, no, 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 everything is too busy. And we were going off on the camp staff cruise up to Princess Louisa Inlet after the summer was over. Wallace invited his father to go on the cruise unbeknownst to me. It was a beautiful full moon evenings and beautiful weather in beautiful places, and we fell in love. And he asked me to marry him. He said he was going to divorce his wife and marry me. Well, he had a law firm in Oakland, California, head of the Oakland Council of Churches, lay leader in his church, and she was very active with the Oakland Symphony, and my family had Kaiser Center in Oakland, California. I thought this will be big news and headlines and the social thing, and it's going to make a big mess of a lot of people's lives. And I said, no. And he said, well, we'll keep seeing each other on the side. And I said, no. And he said, we'll keep in touch. And I said, no. So I just went on about my life.
Okay. But obviously at some point you reconnected with him.
Well, his wife died.
I see.
And my marriage to Andrew the Hungarian had just come apart. And I was at my home on Orcas, sobering up and everything. And he called again and said, will you marry me? And I said, yes. And he said, I'm coming up to see you. And I said, no. I said, I need 6 months to sober up, dry out, and get healthy again. So 6 months later, he came up and asked me to marry him. And I said, yes.
Good. And so did you move to Oakland?
Yes. That was the pits.
Yeah. Well, you must have missed the water and the sailing.
I did. Well, yeah, I did. He had apartment buildings on Lake Merritt, and I moved my shell up from Orcas to Lake Merritt, and I rode my shell on Lake Merritt.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, around this region, you're known a large part about your connection with the schooner Martha. And I looked up a little background on Martha, which was built in 1907. For the San Francisco Yacht Club Commodore J.R. Hanafy, and it's named after his wife. Planking is fir and silver Bali on oak frames, interior Honduran mahogany, leaded glass cabinetry below deck. It was owned by James Cagney from 1934 to 1943, which is an interesting tidbit.
Yeah, it was in some movies.
Your father, Edgar Kaiser, purchased it in 1968.
Right.
So why did he buy it?
Well, the camp had always had a big sailboat. When I took over the camp, the couple that had been running it owned the big sailboat that the camp had been using, and it left with them. So we went together to find a big sailboat. And we were up and down the Pacific coast, and boy, did we find some awful dogs. One, I remember, had green enamel plumbing. All of it was, and there's green bathtubs and green toilets and green. No, not a camp boat.
It doesn't sound like it, but no. Ultimately you found the Martha.
Yeah, we found the Martha in San Francisco.
And was it in good enough shape that you could sail it up to the Puget Sound?
Oh, yes. Yeah, she needed some work, but yeah, she was in good shape.
So it went to the camp,
mm-hmm.
And you were still running the camp.
Yes.
Now, the Martha is in a foundation now, but there was an accident involving the Martha some years ago. What happened to it?
Well, after I stopped running the camp, she'd been hauled to have Coast Guard inspection. That was an interesting thing. The Coast Guard had never inspected a wooden boat to see if it met Coast Guard regulations. So they didn't know half the timbers were or anything else. And so I would be in the boat with them while they were going through it saying, what's that for? And what's that for? And I would explain. I hadn't had a good bit to do with how the car line was built that's there now. And you know, I was explaining this does this and this does this and this holds it together there. And they were saying, oh, that's interesting.
Teach them a thing or two.
Yeah, right.
You mentioned the Carlin, and I want to get that in. You were so important to the camp on Orcas that they have named a boat after you, the Carlin.
Their big boat.
Their big boat. How big is the Carlin?
She's 61 feet.
And the kids sail
on it. She's a yawl, yeah.
They sail on that every summer.
Yeah, right. And then she goes to a children's youth group in Seattle in the winter to be used because, you know, she's too big and valuable an asset to just lie fallow for 9 months. So.
Right. Yeah. I can see that. That makes perfect sense. During the years that you were involved with the Martha, you mentioned about having some auctions and having parties on board to help raise money for it.
No, that was totally different. My husband was born in South Dakota, and he was terrified of the water. He couldn't swim. And so I had to think of an excuse to get him out on the boat. So when I had Shekinah, 61-foot, well, she was a cutter, which is several head sails, we would go to these big charity auctions, and he would have causes that he wanted to support.
Right.
So I would say, okay, we'll sell off a two-week cruise on Shekinah. And we'll take the people out on them and feed them and everything and take them on a cruise. So he agreed to do that. So that's how I got him out on the boat, too.
A little bit devious, but it worked,
yes,
it was, huh?
Right, yeah.
Well, that really sounds like fun. I know you've also done a lot of traveling over the years. You mentioned earlier in England going on boats on the canals.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little?
The English canal system is very extensive. It's all through England. And it was how all of the crops and the merchandise, factory products and everything were moved around the country on these canals. And when trucking came in and roads were built, then the canals were just sitting there empty. So some smart person said, well, let's turn this into a tourist industry. So you can charter a canal boat, and you run it yourself, and you do the cooking on it, and you do everything, and they give you this neat little guidebook that shows you where all the pubs are along the way and where all the restaurants are and where you can get fresh water and fuel, and you just go around the canals in England. And you have to be careful you don't follow what you think is the same canal, but you actually made a turn off, and suddenly you're in totally strange territory where nothing matches.
Oops.
Yeah.
Well, years ago, when you also spent a great deal of time in Alaska, I believe, in the summertime, didn't you go up to Alaska?
Well, on my own boat, when I used to go off for the whole summer, and I would end up as far north as Sitka, yeah. That was wonderful days when, and they had, you know, great charts that showed where all the mountains were and everything. And you could say, oh, I think if we went out here and up this little nook here and then took that jog there, we could sit there and, you know, there's a glacier up there and we could watch it, you know, calving, and we could do this. And it was just a wonderful area to cruise in. Now it's much more mobbed. Desolation Sound was desolate at that time. Now it's full of people and boats and...
Yeah, it sounds beautiful the way you describe it.
The Octopus Islands were absolutely delightful, and there was never anybody there, but now it's just, it's a whole bunch of little islands in this big bay, but now it's just full of people. So.
Okay, well, how did you happen to end up in Port Townsend? I mean, we're relatively near to Orcas, of course, but how did you end up in Port Townsend?
Well, when he died, we were living in Oakland, and I always told him he was the only human on Earth I would live in Oakland for. So when he died, I moved to the home I had on Orcas Island.
Right.
And after 8 years on Orcas, I guess I got cabin fever. I, you know, couldn't afford just to travel the world, and had nobody to travel the world with. And so I took my boat over to Port Townsend to the Wooden Boat Festival 1 year. And the boat wasn't in the festival, but I just wanted to look at the boats.
Right.
And I just walked around and said, ooh, this is a wonderful place. So I found Chris Oda, this delightful real estate person, and she showed me some houses, and I eventually bought the first house she showed me and moved.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what do you like about Port Townsend? What keeps you here?
I don't know how to put it into language. It's the feeling that everybody's equal. It doesn't matter where you came from. It doesn't matter how important you are to other people. It's how you treat your neighbors and how kind you are and thoughtful and generous. It's a generosity of spirit that's here, and you have to fall in with that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the show today, Carlin. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ Port Townsend. I'm the host, Maryam McNellis. Our Town profiles some of the amazing, unique individuals who make up the fabric of this community. My guest today has been Carlin Stark. Most of the boating community know Carlin well. She was the first, or one of the first, people to step up and donate money to help get the Maritime Center off the ground. She's been on the board of both the Maritime Center and the Wooden Boat Foundation for years. She gives generously of her time and passion, and has been particularly passionate about getting children involved in boating. One of the teaching vessels is named after her, the Carlin, sails every summer with loads of excited kids on board. In addition to thanking Carlin, I want to thank the man in the glass booth, my partner, John McPherson. He's the editor and producer of Our Town. He makes me and my guests sound so smooth and eloquent. Thanks also to Larry Stein, program director, Robert Ambrose, chair, and Kate Ingram, station manager. All three work tirelessly to make KPTZ the best community station possible. Thank you, the listener. KPTZ is community supported, and we need all of your support. We always need financial support, but we also need volunteers, so just drop by the station, come on in, and see what we're all about. That's it for today, folks. Meanwhile, keep listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Maryam McNellis and engineered by John McPherson.